Aloha from Hawaii. No, it's not Elvis Presley, it's Chris Makowski. And today on the Emerging Civil War podcast, I'll be joined by author Paul Taylor. We'll be talking about the impact and influence of the American Civil War on the island nation of Hawaii. Today on the Emerging Civil War podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Civil War Trails, the world's largest open-air museum, offering over 1,500 sites across six states. Civil War Trails puts you in the footsteps of famous generals, freedom fighters, and tenacious women. Follow the great campaigns turn by turn, take a historic hike, and explore beautiful downtowns. Snap a signed selfie along the way. Request your brochure today at civilwartrails.org. Follow Civil War Trails and create some history of your own.
Welcome to the Emerging Civil War podcast. I'm Chris Makowski, and joining me today is historian and author Paul Taylor. Paul, how are you today?
Doing great, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Delighted to have you with us. Now, Paul's the author of 8 books. He's got book number 9 coming out soon. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. But the reason I asked Paul to join us is because, as some folks know, I went on vacation to Hawaii in April, and I saw little fingerprints of the Civil War even out there, and mentioned it in the April ECW newsletter. And Paul was kind enough to reach out and said, like, you know, I've actually written a little about that. And I was like, tell me more. So Paul, thanks for coming on to tell me more.
Okay.
So let me ask you, like, what attracted your attention to Hawaii and the Civil War in the first place?
Well, great place to start, Chris. I guess ever since about 2008, my family and I have had the pleasure of visiting Hawaii probably about, 6-7 times from then towards now. And like, I think most of us probably in the Civil War community, whenever we go somewhere new, we often wonder and ask ourselves, boy, was there any kind of activity or impact here? So I started rooting around a little bit about Hawaii, knowing, of course, that it was a kingdom back in the mid-19th century. And I found out that, you know, while there certainly weren't any battles or military activity, our American Civil War did have quite an impact on the Hawaiian kingdom.
And you have written about this in a digital piece that people can download from Amazon. So let me make sure that you have the chance to talk about that for just a second, so that if people do want to know more about this, they've got a pretty cool resource they can go check out.
Excellent.
So
the piece is titled Kekaua Ma America, which is Hawaiian, meaning the war in America. And then I've subtitled it, The Impact of the American Civil War on the Kingdom of Hawaii. It's a 4,000-word essay, nothing too terribly long, and basically is a fairly good overview, I'd like to think, on how our rebellion impacted what was then known as the Sandwich Islands.
I gave it a 5-star rating, so I think it was pretty good, too.
Thank you.
So the Sandwich Islands, that, of course, speaks to the British influence after Hawaii was discovered by Captain Cook. But the sort of balance of power in the Pacific shifts toward America even before the war. And the name sort of reverts back to Kingdom of Hawaii from its Anglicized, can I say that word? Name of Sandwich Islands. I was surprised when I was out there that the British Union Jack is still part of Hawaii's state flag, though.
That kind of surprised me as well. But I guess they've always maintained some cultural ties to the British. But as you said, Chris, in the decades leading up to the Civil War, American missionaries, for the most part, as well as American maritime interests slowly but surely brought the then Sandwich Islands more under American influence than British by the time the war started.
You had a great line in your piece that talked about that missionary influence. And you said that most of those missionaries were from New England, and the missionaries were trying to turn the Hawaiian people into good old New England men and women.
Yeah. Because there was back then, there was nothing better in the New England mindset than hearty New England stock.
And of course, we think about the Southerners, having great pride of South, but gosh, there was nobody like New England to a New Englander,
Yes,
that's for sure.
yes.
But that ends up having a profound impact on the thinking of Hawaiians when the war breaks out, because they do sort of trace their Americanization to New England as opposed to different parts of the country. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, one of the things that I found interesting was that when the American missionaries began their work, one of the first things they did, and probably the largest thing they did, was create a system of writing. Because the Hawaiian culture at the time had no formal alphabet or written language. Everything was of the oral tradition. So once the missionary completed that task in the 1850s, they then, of course, introduced the Hawaiians to the Bible. And by the time the war started, they felt that they had properly Christianized a considerable portion of the population. And of course, brought many horrible diseases with them that, of course, the Hawaiian people were had never ever been exposed to, things like measles, mumps, diphtheria, which just throughout the remainder of the 19th century just decimated the population.
The New England influence also sort of cultivates a pro-union sentiment because of abolitionism as well. And you talk a little bit about how labor conditions in Hawaii were such that the idea of slavery was pretty repulsive to the Hawaiians because of some of their own past experiences.
Yes, they had become ex familiar with what was known as the coolie trade, which was the forced labor of Chinese and some Hawaiians on the islands. So, because of that, there was considerable repugnance towards the Confederate cause and their reliance on slavery. I believe I pointed out there that a good amount of the population, because of the American influence, was pro-Union in its sentiment. However, the royal family leaned somewhat towards Confederate sympathies, in large part because of the racism that the kings felt they had endured at northern hands when they visited Washington and other areas.
You talk about a King Kamehameha. Am I saying that right?
Kamehameha, I think, is what it
Kamehameha. Okay, see, of course
was.
I get it wrong. And
Kamehameha.
as soon as you say it, it's like, well, yes, that sounds a little better. King Kamehameha. And you talk about King Kamehameha the Fourth going to California and having porters at hotels, treat him with disdain like he's just some, colored rabble from the street, as opposed to the king of his own kingdom. And that really sours him toward this, toward the north a little bit.
Absolutely. And he would write that he never experienced such racial discrimination when he had traveled through Europe.
Where he was treated in very regal fashion, as I recall.
Yes. Yes.
So he officially sets a course of neutrality for the kingdom, even though he's leans southern, the populace tends to lean northern. Why does he choose to not take sides?
Well, he's was I don't think he wanted to see shells from either side being lobbed into the Hawaiian ports. The American whaling interests were very important. He was on a political tightrope, and he just did not want to offend and maybe suffer the consequences from either side. Best to leave well enough alone. He felt it really wasn't our war, which is why he decreed that their neutrality, that they would have a policy of neutrality.
And I think that, I mean, you point out in the book too that sort of the political emissaries that the North was sending weren't the top rate sorts of men, and were maybe making some poor impressions. But Kamehameha recognized that there was still some military might behind that. So he's, again, that tightrope you mentioned.
Exactly. That was one of the interesting things I learned, Chris, that back in the mid 19th century, to be a diplomat and to be sent to some far off port of call like that was not viewed favorably. You were being basically banished to some backwater. And therefore, usually it was bottom of the barrel diplomats that would be sent there. And I think I even quote Seward. It advises Lincoln officially that our position in the Sandwich Islands could be at risk unless we up our game a little bit as far as the quality of our diplomats there.
And you talk about how like Lincoln sort of has this epiphany when Kamehameha IV dies and his brother takes over as King Kamehameha V, and Lincoln steps up his game in that moment.
Yeah, he sends him a very, very pleasant, very formal and friendly letter, which impressed the king greatly, and went a long way to solidifying Union influence in the islands.
So aside from, kind of the top-down leadership, you talk a lot about the people themselves being very pro-union, and there are some grassroots efforts among the people to like, let's go sign up and go, that sort of thing. Tell me a little bit about some of those efforts, which I thought
Yeah,
were
well,
kind of hilarious on one level.
I think I wrote that one man actually formed a small battalion of Lancer cavalry troops, which were going to be offered and which were refused. Though a number of Hawaiians actually did serve. I think it was several hundred in the Union Army, albeit, I believe, within the USCTs, and are now buried in various military cemeteries. So there were no formal offers of troops accepted, though a number of Hawaiians did serve in the Union Army.
You told a great story about that cavalry regiment as they're practicing their drill and they've got wooden sabers. There's a boys unit that gets together and
Yeah,
they've got wooden sabers
medical
and
school and all of that. Yeah. So, and I think I mentioned that at the time there were two English language newspapers. One was definitely pro-Union and the other one leaned Confederate. So you definitely had the war being fought out in the newspapers.
and there were straw polls associated with the papers and the elections as well. How did those elections go, those straw poll elections go?
I think they were definitely pro-Union. The majority of the populace, not of course not everybody, but the majority of the populace leaned towards the Union. And again, I think to a large degree, there was a Hawaiian cultural aversion to slavery because they had seen some of it firsthand within their islands.
Now, one of the other things you talk about is, just the many commercial interests. You've touched on it just a little bit, but we've talked about the religious influence, we've talked about the political influence. Tell me a little bit more about this commercial influence that, really makes Hawaii in the Union column.
Well, whaling at the time, though perhaps beginning to fade, was still big business. You had an entire fleet of northern whaling ships operating in the Pacific. Hawaii was a processing point. And then towards the end of the piece, I mentioned how the Confederate raider Shenandoah at the end of the war and even after Appomattox, because they didn't know, just wreaked havoc on northern whaling interests in the Pacific. I think I told one interesting tidbit how they actually captured one whaling vessel, which technically flew a Hawaiian flag, and they ordered all crew ashore at some island and then just burned the ship to its waterline.
And this was exactly what the Hawaiians were afraid of. They wanted to stay neutral because they didn't want these sorts of things.
They did not want to see some warship parking itself off the coast and lobbing shells into their port cities.
Their concerns about raiders and on the commerce lines became so strong that they did eventually petition the U.S. Navy for protection of those commerce routes, as I recall.
Yes, some of the American maritime interests in Hawaii did make formal petitions for protection, but nothing came of it. The U.S. Navy was just not in a position to send ships out into the middle of the Pacific Ocean to protect a relatively small interest. I think in recently, I've read that the Hawaiian Islands are the one piece of land that is farthest from any other continent on the entire globe. So for the US Navy at the time to send a ship out into the middle of nowhere just was not a realistic possibility.
It sure felt like that flying out there.
It's a long flight.
There's just a lot of water down there.
Yes.
There was a great memo that you included in the book from the commander of the Pacific Fleet, who says, like, everyone's bombarding me with requests, and everyone says their harbor is the most important, including the Sandwich Islands, and I don't have a way to cover all this stuff. I mean, the naval action in the Civil War was not on the West Coast anyway.
Yes.
And so, you can sort of read his exasperation in this memo that you included.
Yeah. I recall I liked one comment I recorded where at the midst of the war coming home to the southern home front, a young southern woman writes in her diary like, "Oh, if only we could be in the Sandwich Islands and away from all of this." So even back then it held an allure for the populace that many of us still feel today.
For the diplomats, it was exile, but for people, it was paradise. So now you mentioned that the whaling industry was, kind of on its last flippers by that point, but a key commodity that was taking its place in the Hawaiian economy was sugar. Why did that transition take place?
Well, it be as whaling was fading, Sugar became quite a cash crop because they were able to fill a need that so the South was blockaded. Southern production of sugar, I believe, was hindered. So they were able to pick up some of that slack in that. And
And you talked a little bit about sugarcane coming out of Louisiana in particular, and that reminded me of an experience I had when I was doing a virtual field trip for the American Battlefield Trust, and we were in New Orleans, and as we were taking a riverboat cruise down the river from New Orleans to the Chalamet Battlefield, we had to pass this giant Domino sugar factory, and there was this barge loaded down with sugar and a big industrial crane that was just scooping it up and then moving it into this other, and like there's sugar falling out like it's a snowfall, and like there were so much they didn't even care that it was just spilling over the place. And
all
so
over the
that,
place.
reading that in your book, really brought to mind that, here you've got this massive sugar production that's suddenly cut off. Where are we going to get it? And Hawaii was the perfect place.
That because remember, whaling, by the time the Civil War started, whaling was, it was still a factor, but it was starting to fade. So sugar was the obvious replacement.
So now, when you have gone up to Hawaii on your own trips and adventures, have you tried to track down any traces or remains of any sort of Civil War history as you've been out there?
I have not, Chris. I would suspect that anything of that nature would be on the island of Oahu, Honolulu area. And my family's vacation spots tend to be other islands, though I have been there. I will, that said, I do hope to be back on Oahu in about a year, and I hope to be able to do a little bit more of that.
Now, in the one thing that really kind of, lit a little light bulb for me, because you mentioned there are 30 Civil War vets that are buried in a cemetery together in Oahu. And as soon as I read that, I'm like, oh, I want to go see that. So now I've got something on my checklist too, thanks
There you
to
go.
you.
If you Hawaii is quite a history, and if you peek under the sheets and around the corner, and it's a fascinating history.
To me, the kind of the first Civil War trace I tripped over when I was out there, and I wasn't expecting anything, but we were going from Oahu up to the North Shore, and we passed Schofield Barracks, named after John Schofield. And I'm like, why is there, an army post out here named after John Schofield? And so I dug around a little bit and discovered that in 1872, he was sent to Hawaii, and he's the first person to recommend that the US actually put a base at Pearl Harbor. And so he eventually goes on to become general in chief of the army. And so, of course, they're going to name things after general chief of the army. And so they name this barracks for him out there in Hawaii in honor of that connection from Pearl Harbor. And I just, it's one of those things that reminds me that the war just has its fingerprints everywhere. It's pretty incredible.
Indeed. It's,
So,
you don't, usually you don't even have to look too far.
And then I was also brought to mind, so I went to Pearl Harbor. That was my reason for going to Oahu, was to go to visit the USS Arizona Memorial, which was a deeply moving experience. Have you had the chance to visit the Arizona Memorial?
I did. I saw that one time when I was there. Would definitely love to go back. And as a sidebar, Chris, I just well, because you shared on social media that the last surviving member of the USS Arizona passed away today
Oh, geez. Yeah, that's right. That's
or
right.
yesterday.
So,
Age
an
102.
incredible story, and what a poignant sight that was. And
Yep.
it brought to mind for me a wonderful essay that my colleague Dwight Hughes posted at ECW several years ago about how, for the Civil War Navy, there aren't monuments the way that there are on battlefields all across the continent, to regiments and fighting. And aside from the buoy that's right off the coast from Fort Morgan, from the Battle of Mobile Bay, there just really aren't a lot of, Civil War memorials to sailors. And so to visit this, what I would argue is the most famous naval memorial in American history was just, just a powerful, powerful experience.
It's one of the most poignant, tourist, for lack of a better term, trips I've ever had. It's so moving.
It was kind of neat. The ranger reminded us this is not an attraction. This is a memorial. This is a cemetery. Treat it like you would Arlington. And I thought that was a great reminder because it was
Yes,
really, really
very good
powerful.
point.
So it was.
I will never forget when I was there, and they had taken us in the small transport out to the Arizona Memorial. There were 10 elderly Japanese people as well,
Wow.
and they were very somber. It was not a, it was a memorial.
That sense of cultural responsibility that
Yes.
wow. So I suppose I'd like to shift gears from the warm climes of the Pacific, as wonderful as it is to spend some time in Hawaii. I want to talk a little bit about your new book while I've got you. It's weeks away, you said. Tell us a little bit about what it is and what we can expect.
Sure. The book is titled "Tis Not Our War: Avoiding Military Service in the Civil War North." And I just realized that there's been a lot of work written over the years, talking about all of the men who rushed off to fight in the war. The numbers are anywhere from 33 to 40% of military age Northern men went off to fight. And I it just wanted to look at look at it through the other side of the looking glass. And I just said, well, that means 60 to 67% of men made a carefully considered, conscious decision not to serve. Why? And that's basically how I approach the book. And the more the book is written from what would be known as a bottom up perspective. I've tried to focus on the letters and diaries of those people at the Northern home front, newspapers, rather than top down generals, politicians, and what have you. And I discovered that those are, diaries and letters from the Union home front are relatively scarce when compared to the colossal amount of letters and diaries from soldiers in the field. But I felt that I came up with a very strong portrait of a Northern home front that had a significant amount of indifference and apathy towards the war in general, what it was about, why it was being fought, who was going to fight it. It was not all pomp and circumstance. Yes, it was in April and May 1861. But after that, it started to dissipate. And once the Union came out with the Militia Act in August of 1862, and then Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation a month or so later, it just went off the cliff to a large degree, as evidenced by the four major drafts that the Union Army or the Union government had to put forth in order to get men into the army.
It's funny because you use that word apathy, which is not a word that people typically associate with the Civil War at the time, because you definitely have the pro-union sentiment, and then you have the abolitionist sentiment, you have the copperheads, and you hear about these various very partisan forces, pro and con, in the North. But you don't hear like, there were people that are kind of ambivalent about it. Was that a surprise to you? It's a surprise to me to hear it. Tell me.
Somewhat. I mean, you had a lot of what I described and felt, there was a lot of people, men and their families, men of military age, who supported the war, in theory. They wanted to see it, prosecuted to the proper conclusion, but they had no intention whatsoever of going into the Union Army. They had businesses to run, they had farms to manage, they had families to raise. And I often like to compare the past and the present. And the more I do that, the more I realize that nothing ever changes. There was a lot of good for thee, but not for me, as far as serving in the Union military. And I mean, when you, I think the number was there was something like 776,000 men drafted over the four national drafts between 1863 and February of 65. And of that number, only 6% were actually held to service. The remainder either paid the commutation fee, or they hired a substitute, or they obtained a medical exemption because they couldn't, perform, or they were technically deserters by simply failing to report to their mustering station. But it was a very interesting book to research and write about, and I think it paints a little bit different picture.
When you talk about that surplus of men, and people just not going to the front, and you compare that to kind of the situation the Confederacy was in by 1864, and they're, scraping the bottom of the barrel to get guys to go to the front. And the North just has oodles of men yet to draw on for various reasons that they haven't. That's a pretty stark vision for me.
Yeah, I mean, I have a number of primary sources in the book of people commenting how in Washington and elsewhere, how you would never think, other than for the newspapers, you would never know there's a war going on. Men lounging around who have apparently no intention of serving whatsoever. It was quite interesting. And another thing, Chris, a gentleman by the name of Larry Tagg wrote a book about 20 years ago on Lincoln, and the gist of his thesis, I believe, was that prior to his assassination, Lincoln was not a popular president. And I fully concur with that. In fact, I would dare say that during the 4 years of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln was as unpopular in the North as any modern day 21st century president. I mean, think about this. In the 1864 election, yes, it was a electoral landslide for Lincoln, but nevertheless, 4.5 out of every 10 voters, nearly half, cast a vote against Abraham Lincoln and his policies. Scholars have estimated that another 80,000 votes, a swing of 80,000 votes, in certain states could have made George McClellan president.
Wow. We'd still be
So,
waiting for him to show up for his inauguration.
and in fact, it's probably the soldier vote that carried the day for Lincoln. So, I found it a fascinating and very enjoyable book to research and write.
It's funny you talk about guys just sort of lounging about. I was just doing something recently about photographer Timothy O'Sullivan here at Spotsylvania, and he's taking pictures of, in the immediate wake of the fighting on November 19th. He's grabbing his pictures on the 20th, and he's 24, 25 years old. And I'm thinking, why isn't he in the army? And there were just like lots of people like him that were just sort of going about their business that were of military service age. He later said he was a first lieutenant for a little while at the beginning of the war. Nobody's ever been able to find his records, but it's like, so I mean, that resonates with what you're saying here about just lots of people just going about their business.
Well,
That's
and we've heard the term draft dodgers from the Vietnam War era, but the first real draft dodgers were during the Civil War in the North. Roughly 90,000 men fled into Canada
Yeah.
to avoid the draft.
Wow. Wow. So
So.
now you said that the diaries were hard to come by from the home front. How did you go about researching this book?
Well, I did find a lot, but I just want to stress that when you compare home front letters and diaries in quantity compared to the number of soldier letters and diaries, it's a much smaller amount. I working my way through all of the various repositories, looking for letter collections and diaries written by those from the home front. Certain states were easier than others. As I live in the Midwest, so I was able to visit a lot of the places in person. But just focusing on primary sources and newspapers, and then with some secondary sources for added context.
I liked your word colossal number of soldier letters. A colossal number, which is true.
Yeah,
So,
they're
and that
everywhere.
reminds me, I had a question I didn't ask when we were talking about Hawaii. How did you research that book, being from the Midwest and not from out there?
Oh my goodness. I guess I own a couple of basic Hawaiian histories
Okay.
and just kind of started there and working my way backwards, seeing what might have been out there.
Okay.
I did some research online at the University of Hawaii to see what they might have. I call it literary archaeology.
Yeah.
Just getting out there and digging, and you never know what you'll find.
Yeah. So your new book, when is it due, and who's the publisher?
Stackpole Books
Okay.
by Roman and Littlefield, the publisher. I believe the technical publish date is June 12th, but should be available several weeks before that. It's up on Amazon right now, as a matter of fact.
Fantastic. Very cool. Very cool. Well, anything I haven't asked you tonight, Paul, that I should have?
Chris, I think you've done a great job. We covered all the bases on the Sandwich Islands and the Hawaiian Kingdom.
Very good. If I could, I would put a lay around your neck and let you part with some floral beauty.
We
But I appreciate you taking the time to chat tonight.
should have made some Mai Tais
See, that would have been the that's it right there. Get some hula girls to come out, we could really done it up. So
There you
next
go.
time, I suppose. So, Paul, thanks for being with us tonight.
Chris, thank you. Enjoyed it.
It's my privilege. I'm Chris Witkowski for the Emerging Civil War podcast. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you online and on the battlefield. Thanks to our sponsor, Civil War Trails, the world's largest outdoor museum with more than 1,500 sites across 6 states. You can start planning your trip now by downloading a free brochure at civilwartrails.org. Thanks to our producer, Edward Alexander, and our sound engineer, Jackson Mikowski. Thanks to the 2nd South Carolina String Band for the theme music that they provide. You can find those guys on YouTube and on Facebook. Just search for 2nd South Carolina String Band. And don't forget to join us online at Emerging Civil War. We've got more than 30 historians contributing free content every day. Lots of different writing styles, interests, backgrounds. And we want you part of that great conversation about America's defining event. Join us at emergingcivilwar.com. If you like what you heard here on the Emerging Civil War podcast, please share, like, subscribe, let your friends know. We've got lots more great content coming up. We want you to listen in and be part of this conversation as well at the Emerging Civil War podcast. For Paul Taylor, I'm Chris Mikowski. Thanks so much for being with us here on this episode. We'll see you online and on the battlefield.